Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to make a few remarks about the subject of war and democracy and the pity of war. You all know the background. An estimated 10,000 civilians have died in the east of Ukraine since fighting began. It's a war that has now entered its fourth year. It has produced something like 1.5 million refugees. There are currently 60,000 Ukraine soldiers on the front. It's a strange war, a low-level asymmetric war, a permanent war prosecuted by Russia. It is also a media war. There are so-called rebel media that are blocking websites. There is a Russification of local Ukraine media. This is part of the war effort. And amidst all of these developments, the current template for peace, the second version of the so-called Minsk Accords, haven't been implemented and are actually unpopular among growing numbers of Ukrainian citizens. This is a war which has led to the carving up of territory. 7% of Ukraine's territory is under occupation, and something like 400 kilometers of Ukraine's borders are actually not under any decisive control. This is the background, and it's against this background of the emergence of war and the implication of Ukraine in war that I want to say three broad things about the situation, about democracy and war, beginning first with some discussion about Putinism. This low-level, slow-motion, permanently smoldering war has, as one of its architects, Vladislav Surikov. He is the dramaturg who is close to Putin, who has spoken much about new forms of 21st century war. And one can say that this low-level, slow-motion, permanently smoldering war, which damages lives, is an intrinsic feature of Putinism. This raises the question, what kind of polity is Russia? Some people say, John McCain, Senator John McCain from the United States, said that Russia actually is something like a gas station that's masquerading as a state. There are others, Karin Dawishar, the scholar, is a case in point, who speaks about Russia as a kleptocracy, you know, as a polity where the small ruling group steals wealth and power from the bulk of the population. There is a lot of silence about Putinism, no comments. And there are, of course, people who, the Putinversteher in Germany, who are actually sympathetic in a way to Putinism. They say something like, yes, this regime maybe a kleptocracy, but in fact, it is our neighbor, and we should treat it with some respect because we do not want further tensions. I want to say to you that this Putinism, which is responsible for the ongoing war in the east of Ukraine, is a 21st century polity. It's a new kind of political power that has the following characteristics. Those who rule at every level do so in the name of the people, the narod. This is a polity in which connections really count. The Russian term is blat. That is, clientelism, patron-client relations operating from top to bottom of the system are one of the organizing principles of this system that binds, so to say, everybody together. It implicates everybody in a system of organized irresponsibility. This is a polity where 50% of the population is dependent upon the state. This is a population that is partly middle class. There is a middle class that's deeply dependent upon the state. This is a polity in which there is indeed a plutocracy, a wealthy group at the top who enjoy benefits. You will meet them in Cyprus. You will meet them in London. You will meet them in Berlin. Putinism is a polity that's media saturated. Radio, television, newspapers, the internet, are in the hands of a few, and this is a system in which there is the creation of a whole mentality that, called Putinism, that shapes the way people live their lives and see the world. Peter Pomerantsev has written a great book on the question of media in Russia, and he notes that there is a kind of vaudeville quality to media in Russia, that there is a lot of game playing, that there is there are multiple narratives that are part of the system, so that, as he puts it, in the afternoon in Moscow, it feels as if you're living in some kind of constitutional monarchy. Later in the afternoon, it feels as though there's a clash of opinions and a plurality of points of view, so that it feels like living in a democracy. By dinner time, it feels some kind of total system, and by the early evening, it feels totalitarian. And this is a system in which there is rule through law, lots of references to law. And this is a system of camouflage violence. Most of the violence that is carried out in Russia under this system of Putinism is camouflaged, and it typically happens at the local level. So that, for example, to take one case, a businessman is kidnapped by thugs, unidentified thugs they're called, placed in a under the sun in wet concrete, and there the concrete dries and he dies and is discovered sometime later, and nobody is arrested. This is somehow the typical form of violence under this Russian system. This is Putinism, a system that has considerable resources inside it to make it durable, a system that depends heavily upon confrontation with enemies, a system that is prone to violence and war. This, the Ukraine, is today facing. I want to say, since we are speaking about democracy and war in this session, I want to say something secondly about the topic of democracy and what I call the democratization of war. Ladies and gentlemen, you will know that one of the reigning orthodoxies during the last several decades has come to be called the democratic peace thesis. The view is that no democracies historically ever fought with each other, that democracy is a friend of peace. It's a species of what the philosophers call consequentialism. You know, the good thing about democracy is that if you have democracy, a democratic state is not prone to go to war with another democracy. We now realize that this democratic peace thesis, which was a way of trying to summarize the subject of democracy and war, we now know that this democratic peace thesis is questionable, and it's questionable for several reasons. Strategically, it got itself into a tangle because during the George W. Bush era, the democratic peace theorists, as Bruce Russett, one of their advocates, later confessed, were bushwhacked. By that he meant that the Bush administration took this democratic peace thesis to say, okay, if it's true that democracies don't go to war with each other, then let's militarily invade Iraq, transform it into a democracy so that it doesn't make war on the rest of the region. We now know that the consequences have been catastrophic of this view. But there's a historical objection to the democratic peace thesis. Scholars such as David Pritchard, Nicole Leroux, and others have pointed out that the early Greek democracies, in particular the Athenian democracy, was bellicose. It was constantly at war. We now know, as I've tried to write in detail in my Life and Death of Democracy, my attempt at writing a history of democracy, we know that there were three democratic empires in the history of democracy, Each one of them was prone to make war. Athens, militarily the most powerful democracy in the region, in the ancient Greek world. Revolutionary France, expressed through Napoleon. And, of course, the United States. It is the first global democratic empire, which is continually at war in our times. So the thesis that democracies don't go to war with other democracies is questionable and, I would say, needs to be rejected. But we can say more about the subject of democracy and war. And here comes, for many of you, a surprise, which is that we now well understand, though it's not widely understood, that actually the very idea of democracy that circulated in the ancient Greek world contained within it connotations of war. Think about it. Demokratia, this noun, a feminine noun that circulated through the many Greek democracies up to perhaps 100 during the 5th and 6th, the 6th and 5th and 4th centuries BCE, use the word democracy and from two roots. Demos, the people, kratin, kratos, to rule or to govern is the usual translation. In fact, the verb kratin was, when used in that period, a word that had connotations of mastery, of conquest, of lording over others, of possessing others, of wanting to be the stronger, of wanting to get the upper hand. What I'm saying, disturbingly, is that that democracy gets off to a bad start in this sense, because the very word itself has connotations of war built into it. But striking, when looking back on the history of democracy, is the way in which actually existing democracies have desacralized war. They've denatured war. They have democratized war in the words that I like to use. That is to say, democracies in action have come more and more to see that war is not natural, that war is not God-given, that war actually is driven by power maneuverings, and that these can be checked, and that war can be eliminated. How does this happen? It happens because democracies promote public openness, where contrary points of view, ways of life can be lived and expressed. It depends upon, democracy depends upon rule of law. Nobody should be above the law. Democracies cultivate free elections. Democracies cultivate civil society. But democracies do something else, which is that they promote a coming to terms with violent pasts, a coming to terms, an attempt publicly to understand the way war and the pities of war ruined people's lives in the past. Here I return to the subject of Ukraine and war and democracy. It has been pointed out, for example, by Tim Snyder and other historians, that the subject of war and democracy in Ukraine is unfinished business, that this subject of war and democracy in Ukraine is essentially about World War II and the unfinished business of World War II. You know that Ukraine was seen by the Nazis as the land of milk and honig, the land of milk and honey. Ukraine was the principal target of the Nazis' Generalplan Ost. That is, the prime goal of the Nazis in their expansionism was to capture Ukraine. And seen in this way, the Holocaust is not understandable without understanding prior to this the Ukraine strategy, the Vernichtungskrieg, the war of extermination that was launched against Ukraine. Think of Babyn Yar, where tens of thousands of people were shot. This is a symbol of this dynamic. The dynamic during World War II, as we now know, included the fact that many Soviet Ukraine civilians were killed, maybe 3.5 million, and that another 3 million Ukrainians were killed as members of the Red Army. The dynamics were, of course, very complicated. Plenty of Ukrainians collaborated with the Nazis, though more Ukraine communists than Ukraine nationalists seem to have collaborated. There were quislings at all levels of the society. And therefore, remembering the complexities of this period of war, a catastrophic war that still, as it were, affects the lives and lives on in the lives of Ukraine today, is a vital condition of the democratization of Ukraine. The point I'm making is that if you look at cases such as Northern Ireland or Tunisia, where there is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission going on, or Chile, you will see that successful democratization of power, power sharing, the introduction of rule of law, of openness, of free and fair elections, of greater equality among citizens, democratization in this sense requires as well the democratization of memory. No country that is democratic can afford to have a single memory about the past. And for this reason, I doubt that Viatrovich's campaign currently for the decommunization of Ukraine is plausible. What Viatrovich and others want to say is that the prime aim must be to rid Ukraine, this young potential democracy, of the Soviet influence, to get Bolshevism out of the heads of every Ukraine, as Viatrovich puts it. It seems to me that, strategically speaking, this kind of thinking plays into the hands of the Russian media's charge that the Ukraine government are actually all Banderovtsi, that is, followers of Stephen Bandera. I think as well that this decommunization of memory in Ukraine, this campaign for decommunization, is actually a campaign that contains unfortunate silences about the complexities of the war and the way World War II shaped contemporary Ukraine. I don't have an easy solution to this, but I would say that open public debate, open the plurality of institutions that can foster memories of World War II are a basic condition of democratization in contemporary Ukraine and dealing with the problem of the current war. That is to say, Ukraine is confronted by two wars, not only the present struggles against Putinism in the East, but also unfinished business, the problem of coming to terms with the past, that is, the past, the traumatic past of World War II. I want to say that a healthy democracy among the living requires democracy among the dead, that is, a democratization of memory, a sense that memory is produced, a sense that memories are contingent, and that honesty, openness, and respect for the complexities of the past is a very important condition of democratization. I want to say one final thing about the subject of democracy and war and Ukraine. When a would-be democracy is at war, when it is confronted with problems of corruption, of economic stagnation, of geopolitical uncertainty, intelligent leadership counts for a great deal. Democracies require leaders. They don't require demagogues. Demagogues are antithetical to democracy, but they require prudent, intelligent, courageous leadership. And I want to give an example of this. You all know that in earlier this year in March 2017, there was a decision taken by the Ukraine authorities to bar Russia's entrant to the Eurovision Song Contest. The Russian entry was a disabled young woman. The barring of this young woman, Samoylova, caused an outcry within the Russian media. The charge that Ukraine is a state of paranoia, a state whose people are riddled with nationalist complexes, a state that is actually fascist. What could have happened, an alternative scenario, was that the Ukraine authorities could well have actually banned Samoylova from entering Ukraine back in 2015 when she performed in Crimea. They could have done that, but they could also have actually invited Samoylova to participate in the Eurovision Song Contest and to make sure that she was confronted, for example, with disabled Ukraine soldiers freshly returned from the front. She would then have been forced to explain the current situation. She would have met Ukraine soldiers and would have had to have confronted and explained in media terms their sorrows and their pains and disabilities. It didn't happen. It's this kind of intelligent leadership, I mean, coping with a slow burn, slow motion war, intelligent leadership that strengthens a democracy, that gives courage to people. This is among the priorities facing Ukraine in a difficult and dark situation where war, it turns out, as Orwell said, George Orwell remarked that war is the greatest enemy of democracy. Thank you.